If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This episode of Into the Night is brought to you by our loyal listeners and followers. Fazbear Entertainment appreciates your viewership and those who support the show by commenting, sharing, and subscribing. If you wish to support this broadcast, please consider checking out the official merch store and Patreon for more information.
This episode is the culmination of our Security Breach audiobook series. If you haven't watched from the beginning, we recommend starting at episode 26, Security Breach, and listening to all episodes up to this point to know the full context of the storyline so far. But to be honest, if you haven't done that yet, I'm not convincing you now. Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Five Nights at Freddy's podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. Well, here we are, standing at the river's edge. The story of Security Breach has reached its conclusion. But what lies at the end of this dark and stormy night? Five Nights at Freddy's has never been a franchise easily unraveled. Okay, let's be honest, it never was, at least in its earlier days. Much of the classic lore is now reasonably well mapped, but when it comes to more recent entries, the narrative becomes fragmented, scattered, and, at times, intentionally, frustratingly obfuscated. Unlike earlier games such as Sister Location or Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria Simulator, which features multiple endings but clearly designates one as canon, or Help Wanted, where the true ending merges through DLC and future titles. Security Breach takes more of a FNAF 3 approach. It keeps things real by keeping them unclear. For once, Gregory reaches the exit doors of the Pizzaplex, and Freddy informs him that Gregory must choose to either run while he still can, or stay and uncover the deeper truth. The game stops being linear. Instead, it opens up and interpretation becomes king. The player is given some agency on how they want to end things. You can escape through the main entrance, sneak out through one of the alternative exits, or plunge deeper into the bowels of the Pizzaplex to uncover the dark secrets buried beneath the neon lights. But whatever path you have Gregory choose, one thing remains constant. If you die, you're heading straight back to this crossroads. No, I am not joking. So, in a classic Steel Elf, for reasons I cannot begin to fathom, the original release of Security Breach decided to disable save points after the pivotal moment where the game enters overtime mode. Yes, they even go out of their way to warn you that sticking around past closing time means forfeiting your ability to save. To call this decision ill-advised would be an understatement of EA proportions. In fact, I believe they even use the EA logic of, we want the player to feel a sense of pride in accomplishments, level of delusional rationalization over that decision. realistically, there is absolutely no justifiable reason to remove the save function here, beyond trying to artificially inflate the game's runtime, especially in a release as rushed, buggy, and duct-taped together as Security Breach. Eventually, though, SteelWool relented to the mountain of backlash and, in a later patch, added a single save station back into the atrium during the endgame. Conveniently, this was bundled in the same patch where they had the goal to claim they were, quote, satisfied with the state of the game, unquote. A game still lacking basic features like a functional stealth system, consistent AI behavior, and a plot that can be understood without requiring a full dissertation or supposedly supplemental novellas to make sense of. Oh gosh. Okay, look. To break the fourth wall, I've held my tongue for quite a while covering Security Breach in the episodes, keeping things focused on the lore and story for those of you who follow along with the main Into the Night series. I haven't done so outside of Shadows Crying, but I also know some people prefer just listening to the episodes in their totality and not the side content. But just for the record, and for anyone listening who hasn't played the game yet, Security Breach is not good. And if this podcast has sparked your curiosity of it, let me be blunt. Do not give SteelWool your money for this game. Not for a game this unfinished, this unfocused, and this insultingly shoddy. Literally, just go buy Secret of the Mimic. It's just a better game in all ways. That said, this is not a review. This is the epilogue in our Security Breach saga, one that will dive into the six major endings available in the game, how to unlock them, what they depict, and the implications they carry. None of these endings, at the time of recording, have been officially confirmed as canon, although one has a very strong case in its favor, but truly none of them fit perfectly into one place. As such, for the time being, it's best to think of these as simple potential conclusions that the story could play out in, but not exactly what has occurred. For the sake of clarity and structure, when we go over each ending, we'll be treating them as though they did happen, in effect, to better explore their meanings before we dive into the murkier waters of the canonical debate. All understood? Perfect. If you are all ready, this is episode 45. What if? Ending 1. Gregory flees the Pizzaplex. This ending can be achieved by reaching the crossroad point at 6 a.m. and choosing to flee the Pizzaplex, leaving Glamrock Freddy behind. If Gregory chooses to leave the Pizzaplex, what follows is Gregory darting across alleyways, lost and alone, with no home to return to. He finds himself deep within the heart of Hurricane, a city now sleek and modernized thanks to Fazbear Entertainment's aggressive local investments and the economic boom they've ushered in. Exhausted from the constant fear and trauma he's endured, Gregory eventually collapses onto the softest scrap of detritus he can find, a battered cardboard box propped on its side to shield him from the biting night wind. He wraps himself in a discarded newspaper, clinging to it like a makeshift blanket. The front page is filled with headshots, missing persons reported from the Pizzaplex, children and adults alike. And in the center of them all is Gregory's own face. As he drifts into the fragile embrace of unconsciousness, he barely registers the iridescent crimson glow beginning to wash over him. A shadow looms, thin and serpentine, with long, floppy ears. It lurches forward, eager to reclaim what was taken from it. Not the most pleasant of endings by any account. This route, often referred to as the bad ending, makes one thing abundantly clear. Gregory leaving the Pizzaplex without Freddy's protection does not mean the danger for him has ended. The Glamrocks may no longer pursue him, but Vanny is not bound by animatronic protocols. The threat will simply shift with the setting, and Gregory is left defenseless against a predator who is human. Beyond the grim fate awaiting Gregory, this ending also subtly reinforces two major lore points. The first is the evolution of Hurricane. We see for the first time in-game that the town, or should I say city at this point, has grown and modernized, an urban sprawl influenced by Fazbear Entertainment's presence and expansion. This aligns with elements teased throughout Tales from the Pizzaplex, giving us welcome continuity between games and the book series, at least on this front. The second point of interest lies in the missing persons report. Whether these disappearances stem from Vanny's actions, the chaos inflicted by the storyteller, or something more sinister, it's clear that Fazbear Entertainment is once again facing public scrutiny, just as they did during the infamous missing children's incident of 1985. Notably, Gregory himself is listed among the missing. According to GGY, we know Gregory had a home life and attended school, meaning at some point he must have vanished from society, disappearing into the depths of the Pizzaplex, much like Vanessa. This ending also supports the theory that Gregory may have been influenced by the Glitch Trap virus, just as Vanessa was. His apparent but not clear escape from its control could explain both his presence in the Pizzaplex after hours and why Vanny is so determined to find him. In essence, Gregory is a loose end, a rogue variable that Glitch Trap, aka the Mimic, cannot afford to let exist. Ending 2. Glamrock Freddy burns down the Pizzaplex. Requirements: this can be achieved by staying in the Pizzaplex longer and collecting almost every single collectible in the game, then retracing your steps back to the VIP area. If Gregory chooses to stay with Freddy and continue their investigation, something peculiar occurs. The two find themselves once more in the third floor VIP lounge, a place Gregory had long since passed through in their earlier escape attempts. Freddy stands still for a moment, his gaze unfocused, as if caught in a quiet storm of memory and thought. Gregory follows Freddy's line of sight toward his outstretched metal paw, which held a small plush replica of himself. Something about the toy shifts something within the animatronic. His stolen eyes, once gentle and confused, hardened with sudden clarity and conviction. Freddy flicked his finger. The tip of his index clicks open with the soft pop of a pen cap, revealing a faint ember, a miniature lighter concealed within his fingertip, likely used for lighting birthday candles. Freddy leaned forward, lowering the flame onto a heap of stuffed toys scattered across the VIP room. The fire lit and started small, but soon the plushes catched, then the carpeting, then the walls. Like a miasma, the blaze spread outward, crawling into the lobby below, then surging through the network of connected halls and attractions that spanned the Pizzaplex. Together, Gregory and Freddy fled through the very fire exit Gregory had once tried to use earlier into the night. Now, with all of his security passes collected, the door finally opened, the stairwell beyond leading to salvation to the rooftops. Gregory, lighter and faster, sprinted ahead while Freddy lumbered behind, his frame struggling to keep pace. Just as Gregory reached the rooftop,
there you are.
A figure lunged from the shadows. Vanny. She grabbed him with a twisted force, her garnet eyes filled with a dark and unmistakable intent. Gregory kicked and struggled, but her grip was unrelenting.
You can no longer hide from me. I have new eyes.
Vanny turned. Freddy, sitting tall at the top of the stairwell, his silhouette backlit by the flickering orange glow of the fire beneath. For the first time, he saw her, truly saw her, and she knew it. Whatever veil had once shielded her from the animatronic's visions had lifted. She was exposed. She dropped Gregory, not a word escaped her lips. Instead, she raised her hands in a fang gesture of innocence, as if to say it was all a harmless joke and just a prank. But Freddy was not amused. He charged toward the rabbit lady. She was too flabbergasted to react. The moment Freddy made contact, he did not stop. He couldn't. The full weight and velocity of his momentum carried both of them over the rooftop's edge. Vanessa's scream pierced the night as she tumbled, arms flailing. Freddy, unable to halt himself, followed her into the void. Gregory sprinted to the ledge, just in time to see them fall. Vanessa writhed in midair. Freddy, by contrast, was calm, resigned. His eyes closed for a moment, accepting fate, then reopened just before the impact, locking with Gregory one final time. The impact came like thunder. The metallic crash of Freddy's body was immense, like a meteorite striking concrete. It was followed by the sickening, unmistakable wet slap of a human form colliding with the pavement. Gregory looked to his right. The fire exit scaffolding was right there. He bolted down the stairwell, the metal structure groaned beneath his hurried steps, the railings vibrating with each turn he made. His breath was ragged in desperation. The pounding of his shoes echoed in time with the sound of the building crumbling from within. Seconds later, his feet touched black asphalt, and he found himself outside the Pizzaplex grounds, just not in the way he had hoped. There, on the ground, laid Freddy. His body was scattered into broken parts, his casing dented, limbs twisted, sparks flickering from exposed wire. And yet, his face was serene, peaceful, the expression of someone who finally fulfilled their purpose. That, in the chaos of it all, that was the only true victory of this night. Freddy had given himself to ensure Gregory no longer had to live in fear. Beside Freddy laid what left of Vanny. A pool of dark crimson oozed beneath her back, soaking and staining her white rabbit costume and spreading outward through the cement. Gregory approached slowly, cautious despite knowing it was impossible for her to strike. She was still and unmoving. There was no doubt she was dead. With trembling hands, Gregory knelt beside her, placed his fingers beneath the chin of the rabbit mask. he lifted gently, revealing the face of Security Officer Vanessa. Her expression frozen in pain and regret etched into every strained feature. Behind him, the Pizzaplex burned. Even through the concrete walls, Gregory could feel the fire's mounting intensity. The glass of the building's windows began to crack and buckle under the pressure of rising heat. Flames licked the edges, climbing higher with each passing second. Gregory looked up, high above, standing solemnly on the edge of the rooftop, where Vanny and Freddy had fallen, was a silhouette behind the rising smoke. It was Vanessa. She gazed down at him, and at Freddy, and at her own lifeless form. No words were spoken. She simply looked down with a solemn expression written on her face. Well, that was certainly something. This ending is abstract in more ways than one. Freddy's abrupt shift in character from his consistent loyalty to his friends to now willing to incinerate the entire Pizzaplex, it raises eyebrows to say the least. Vanessa's sudden appearance on the rooftop also lacks narrative grounding. Why? Why was she up there? How did she know to intercept Gregory at that exact moment? And more baffling, how can she simultaneously be lying on the ground while also gazing solemnly down from above? What is going on there? Does Vanessa have a twin? Thankfully, probably no. But we do need to unpack the imagery. There is a significant piece of confirmed lore in this sequence. The idea that Vanny used some kind of cloaking technology that rendered her invisible to the Glamrock animatronics. Previously, only Roxy could perceive her, and now that Gregory has installed Roxy's eyes into Freddy's ocular sensors, Freddy too can see her. This detail supports a fascinating throughline. Vanessa, whose mind was hijacked by an entity born from a digital realm, can only be perceived through augmented or virtual vision by the robots. The how behind this will be explored in greater depth during Ruin, so for now, we won't dive too deep into the mechanics. What is important is the moment of realization. Vanessa did not expect to be seen, and when she is, she loses control over the situation immediately and pays for it with her life. As for the dual Vanessas, one lying dead beside Glamrock Freddy's shattered remains, and the other watching from the rooftop, that too, I believe, has an explanation, albeit a symbolic one. The Vanessa standing on the rooftop likely represents her spirit, finally freed from the glitch trap virus. Vanny is dead. The infection is purged. But this liberation came at a terrible cost. The rooftop figure isn't a physical body. It's a visual metaphor. The soul bearing witness to the conclusion of her own tragic tale. She watches silently as the Pizzaplex burns, a pyre not just for a building, but for her sins, her guilt, and her fragmented identity. Vanessa's story has ended. There is no resurrection, no redemption arc, no miraculous recovery. Only the haunting silence of a life once lived under possession, now freed and released through the cleansing of the flame. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful, with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. We're talking high-quality, often handmade in the U.S. gifts with actual personality, and the range is wild. Whether you're shopping for parents who say they don't want anything, they're lying, kiddos and teens who want everything, or the book nerd, history junkie, or cocktail crafter, or little gremlin nephew in your life, there's something here that'll make you look like you actually planned ahead this year. And listen, y'all know I am weak when it comes to sweets. So when I saw Uncommon Goods had incredible chocolates around the world set, you bet I locked that into my cart and treated myself this year. And it's not just treats for me. I know my sister-in-law will love some jewelry shaped like her home state. My nephew is absolutely getting a DIY root beer kit so he can feel like a tiny Victorian soda barista. And my mother was already someone who used their extensive holiday decor section to spice up the home when the family gets together. And the cherry on top is that every purchase with Uncommon Goods gives back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice, which means you can feel good while shopping by getting great products, support small businesses, and helping those in need. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/intothenight. That's uncommongoods.com/intothenight for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Thank you, Uncommon Goods, for sponsoring this episode. Hey everyone, Secret Agent Nick here. I'm currently trying to break into the manor of Scott Cawthon to retrieve the lore for Five Nights at Freddy's, and it's all thanks to the skills I have learned from this episode's sponsor, I Expect You to Die. Now, do not skip ahead, because I need to inform you all about I Expect You to Die, a trilogy of Bond-style VR games developed by Shell Games, the same Shell Games whose founder developed one of my all-time childhood favorite games, Toontown Online. I Expect You to Die allows you to play a secret agent saving the world from evildoers like Dr. Zor, from enacting his nefarious plans such as virus bombs, nuclear armaments, and satellite orbiting death lasers. Using your wit, intellect, and telepathic implants, warranty voided upon implementation, you'll be driving supercars out of airplanes, breaking into volcano lairs, and saving the world one mission at a time through brain-teasing puzzles. If you enjoy escape rooms, then this gives them a run for their money, as I've never been more challenged and rewarded when it comes to problem-solving and taking off my flat cap for a Sherlock cap. Because as a super spy, there is no vacations, for evil never rests, and there is no fame, for your cover must be kept hidden. But you don't do this for the glory or seducing women. You save the world for the love of the game. If you are a fan of classic spy films or looking to experience one of the most immersive and hilarious VR games from the entire catalog, then there is no better time to check it out now. Use my link in the description to get 45% off the entire trilogy on the Meta Horizon store. And join the agency and save the world today. Now, if you'll excuse me, I got my own mission to complete. What the? Matthew Patrick, what are you doing here?
Ending 3. Gregory flees the Pizzaplex with Freddy. Requirements. Gregory stays in the Pizzaplex, but chooses to flee with Freddy using the van located in the loading docks by the kitchen.
Okay, so this one is kind of completely random. In this ending, Gregory chooses to remain in the Pizzaplex.
But instead of fleeing alone through the front entrance or torching the place in a Fazbear replication of the burning of the Library of Alexandria, he opts for a far less expected and theatrical route. Gregory, a child, hotwires a car. Yes, you heard that correctly. Despite being, at most, 12 years old and presumably lacking any formal automotive experience, Gregory somehow commandeers a delivery van parked in the facility, and even more amusingly, Freddy, who had previously stated that he cannot leave the Pizzaplex, seems to have a sudden change of heart and hops into the passenger seat. As they blaze down the empty highway, Gregory is practically gleeful. That is, until he sees a small white figure blocking the road. Oh, it's just the map bot. Without hesitation, Gregory slams his foot on the gas, and the poor bot is obliterated on impact.
Take a map.
Splattering against the windshield like an oversized cybernetic insect. It's brutal, comedic, and weirdly cathartic.
You're cringy kid.
But the joyride is short-lived. A low, pained groan emits from Freddy's speaker. Gregory turns to see his animatronic companion slumped into the seat, systems failing. It's as he said, his battery had run dry.
No, no!
Panic set in. Gregory veers off-road, the tires kicking up grass and gravel, and comes to a screeching halt. He pulls Freddy out of the passenger seat and lays him gently as he could onto the earth, and rushes to the back of the van. The rear interior is aligned with scattered tools and tinkering supplies for Fazbear engineers, an odd but convenient stash. Gregory seizes a pair of conduit clamps, pops the hood of the vehicle, and hooks one end to the car's battery and the other to the charging port on Freddy's chest. He hits the ignition. Sparks fly as Freddy spasms, twitching and jolting in an electrifying dance. Gregory kills the engine. Silence follows. Then, slowly, two bright yellow eyes blink open. Freddy rises, renewed. Without hesitation, Gregory launches himself into his arms, the hug warm and genuine. Freddy returns it, and though the car battery is utterly fried, it doesn't matter. With nowhere to go but forward, they begin their long walk home. So, this ending is just all kinds of weird. Never mind the fact that this 12-year-old somehow knows how to hotwire and drive a van, which feels like low-hanging fruit, but it still deserves a mention, I feel like. What really throws me off is how utterly random this route feels. The 6 a.m. crossroads is supposed to carry weight. It frames a moral and narrative tension. Gregory can choose to stay and possibly help Freddy, or he could also just leave right then and there, prioritizing his own safety, and abandon the victims of the Pizzaplex to whatever fate awaits them. Either way, it's meant to be a defining moment for the character. But then there is this ending where Gregory just jumps into a van and pieces out. No plan. No explanation, just a full-on screw-this-I'm-out moment. And Freddy, who, may I remind you, explicitly stated, not even an hour earlier, that he physically cannot leave the Pizzaplex, suddenly decides to hop in and ride shotgun like none of that ever mattered? Continuity? Never heard of her. It honestly feels like an ending that was slapped together out of necessity rather than any genuine narrative desire. Like, the devs needed a quirky, lighthearted resolution and just said, yeah, sure, let's roll with this. And sure, it's undeniably dumb. But there's something kind of endearing about it, too. because at the end of the day, Gregory and Freddy do get their little buddy cop escape into the sunrise. And considering some of the other endings we'll be covering, that's honestly not the worst way for the story to bow out, even if it's a little more than campy. I mean, I liked it. Ending 4. Gregory and Freddy confront Vanny. Requirement: Gregory must have discovered Vanny's hideout in Phazerblast. This will allow Gregory to suggest a confrontation with Vanny during the 6 a.m. crossroad. Freddy's hand remained gently placed on Gregory's shoulders, a silent assurance that he would support whatever choice he made. Beneath the surface, Freddy longed for him to stay, to uncover the truth buried deep within the Pizzaplex's neon-lit shadows. But just as strongly, he wished for Gregory's safety, to see him far removed from harm, far from the friends he might lose, and far from Vanny. Wait a minute. Vanny. That's it.
Well, we saw her hideout, right? In Phazerblast? Maybe we could catch her there. If she thinks I escaped, maybe we can surprise her.
Yes! Come, let us end this.
Gregory and Freddy made haste into Phazerblast. The VIP area was tucked beyond the maze-like corridor to the laser tag labyrinth, and Gregory felt a flicker of confidence. They had the element of surprise. It was past 6 a.m., the night was over, and the day staff would soon return. Vanny would have to vanish, conceal her persona, and bury whatever dark intention she had once again. Together, they ascended the second floor of the neon-drenched shooting gallery, urgency in every step. But as they neared the central platform of the arena, Freddy abruptly stopped Gregory with a protective arm across his chest. Ahead, two staff bots drifted slowly towards them. But these weren't the usual shooting bots. No plastic alien helmets, no playful gestures. Their mechanical eyes weren't even trained on Gregory. They were focused on Freddy. Gregory instinctively stepped back. Freddy raised his fist. If these machines wanted to reach Gregory, they would have to go through him first. Then, Gregory saw a fleeting silhouette in the third floor window. Floppy ears and garnet red eyes. Vanny. She stood above them, unmoved by their arrival, almost as if she'd been expecting it. With a slow wave that was far too childish for someone her age, she whispered under her breath. Yet somehow, even from this distance, Gregory heard it clear as day.
Disassemble, Freddy.
Behind Gregory, two staff bots surged from the shadows, shredding through the platform. Before Freddy could react, they barreled into him, slamming him off the platform like a missile. He struck the first floor with devastating force, cracking the ground beneath him, an impact like a fallen star. Groaning and dazed, Freddy glanced upward toward Gregory, confusion and sorrow etched into his flickering gaze. Emerging from every barrier on the first floor, from behind walls laced in neon light and makeshift laser tag props, the staff bots from the Pizzaplex's underbelly, black graffiti scarred across their shells, "In your dreams," written across their chest. They pounced on the bear. They tore into Freddy, peeling back his plastic casing, diving into his servos, wiring, and metallic heart. Metal screamed, sparks flew. Freddy's voice sputtered into static as they ripped through him piece by piece.
Gregory turned. The staff bots beside him were shifting their gaze now, slowly, mechanically, toward him. Hands raised, ready to disassemble him next. Gregory wouldn't give them a chance. He leapt, vaulting from the second floor to the ground, landing hard on his knees, pain pulsing throughout his legs. He couldn't save Freddy, not like this. There were too many. Even with his Fazcam, it would be suicide. So he ran, diving into a narrow passageway, likely the same one the bots had used. He crawled into the dim utility corridors behind Phazerblast. The sounds of wheels on rubber echoed behind him. And somewhere, not far at all, he could feel that Vanny was following. He kept moving, kept weaving his way, desperate for a solution, desperate for direction.
Come in, Gregory. Can you hear me?
Gregory's eyes went wide. Was he mistaken? He had to be mistaken. That couldn't be.
I still have a signal.
It was. It was Freddy on his Faz watch.
Get to the Phazerblast booth. Use the security desk. Turn them against Vanny.
Gregory swallowed hard. Freddy was near his end. And they both knew it. There was only one path that remained. One inevitable conclusion to the twisted game between Vanessa and Gregory. Someone wouldn't walk away from this. And if Gregory was going to survive, he had to one-up the puppeteer and eviscerate her with her own strings. Gregory pushed forward through the maintenance tunnel until it opened into an offshoot corridor of Phazerblast. This wasn't a guest area, it was staff only. A spiral staircase used by technicians to monitor games and service lighting. He scrambled up, breath ragged with desperation. At the top, a narrow catwalk awaited. From here, you could see not only the VIP section, but also the rear access to the security office. Vanny's lair. She wasn't there. She was on the ground floor now, prowling, searching for him. She had exposed herself, and Gregory was ready. He sprinted across the catwalk, abandoning all pretense of stealth, subtlety, or strategy. None of that mattered anymore. Only the endgame. He tore through the office's rear door, slamming it shut behind him. The room reeked of synthetic fabric and dust. Vanessa's mattress still lay crumpled on the corner, alongside a bizarre arcade cabinet, broken and flickering with ancient graphic LEDs. Gregory dove to the security monitor and brought it online. His fingers flew across the keyboard, overriding the default commands, rewriting the code with something of his own. The door behind him burst open. Vanessa, Vanny, stood in the doorway, cackling wildly. Her fingers stretched out for him, trembling with manic excitement. Behind her, the staff bots loomed ready to fulfill their next task. So, Gregory gave it to them.
Dismantle Vanny! Dismantle Vanny!
He spoke the command and hit the button. The staff bots froze, then twitched. Slowly, they turned toward her. Vanessa's laughter faltered, even through the mask. Gregory saw the fear rising, tangible and immediate. The first bot lunged, then another. Their basic programming unleashed, and they descended on her like apes on a harvest of a fresh kill. It was Bushery. Red-streaked white leather, tufts of synthetic fur, and splashes of blood flew into the air like confetti. Her screams began shrill, then cracked, then stopped altogether.
What remained was the grotesque sound of bones breaking, of blood hitting tile, of robotic arms fulfilling orders without mercy or pause. Gregory turned away. He couldn't watch anymore. He weaved around the carnage and stumbled his way back toward the ground floor. Freddy was still there, barely. A crater of torn endoskeleton and shattered plating surrounding him. His torso was a hollowed cavity. Parts of him were scattered without reason. His faceplate sparked in stuttering bursts. One eye lazily rolled uselessly. The other looked up at Gregory with something close to peace.
Gregory! Gregory!
With the last of his strength, Freddy raised a hand, bare metal now, the plastic shell long broken into million pieces, and rested it gently on Gregory's head, tousling his hair. Cold metal, and yet, somehow, it was warm, soft, human.
You are my super soul.
His hand went limp. And just like that, the light in his eye faded. The quiet hum of his core went still. Gregory kneeled motionless for a moment, letting the tears fall freely. Not for the horrors behind him, but for the heart that had just gone silent.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
There isn't much for me to say on this ending compared to the others. It's easily the most depressing conclusion in Security Breach. My favorite part genuinely is the moment Vanny randomly abandoned her office lair. Like, why? You had the high ground, an army of staff bots at your command and full control of the entire Peaceplex security system. What possible tactical advantage came from leaving your current position? I didn't even bother including the Glamrock band in this betrayal because their appearance makes zero sense. Why would they support Vanessa after Freddy gets literally murdered in front of them? At the very least, you think Roxy might pick up on the red flags. Speaking of Freddy getting absolutely obliterated, what a brutal and disrespectful send-off for the character. The poor guy shields Gregory from everything the Pizzaplex throws at them, only to be torn apart like a Lego minifigure by some glorified Roombas. Here's a genuine lore question I have, though. How exactly is it that the Glamrocks can't perceive Vanessa, but the staff bots can? Like, the only reason Roxy and eventually Freddy can see her is because they have an experimental ocular upgrade. Are we now saying that all staff bots come standard with this top-tier VR tech? If that's the case, then congratulations! Your cheaper by the dozen Aperture Science knockoff iRobots are now more advanced than your headliner acts. Great design philosophy there, Fazbear Entertainment. In the end, this route kind of collapses under its own weight. No satisfying lore payoff, no major revelations. Hell, I'm pretty sure Markiplier laughed his ass off during this ending. It's just a messy sequence of events topped with a cool and brutal send-off of a lackluster villainess. That is the genuine one actual compliment I'll give this ending. How effectively the staff bots were recontextualized into a legitimate threat. Up until now, they've mostly been a minor inconvenience. Both here in this audiobook retelling, but absolutely in the game as well. But for a fleeting moment here,
they become terrifying. Still, that highlight doesn't save the whole. The rest, yeah, this ending kind of blows. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Ending 5. Gregory investigates the sinkhole below Roxy Raceway. Requirements: Gregory must choose to stay behind in the Pizzaplex, decommission all the Glamrocks, and integrate all upgrades into Glamrock Freddy to gain access to the locked-off zone in Roxy Raceway. Gregory stood beside Freddy in front of a rickety elevator. He had known, thanks to the internal messages he'd snooped through, that Roxy Raceway had its fair share of maintenance issues. What he hadn't expected was the security they'd implemented to keep people out. Rather than retrace his steps through the infernal basement where he'd nearly melted alive, Gregory had scoured the employee maps he had collected and uncovered a tucked-away access point, hidden beneath the bleachers of Roxy Raceway, cleverly hidden out of sight from guests. After descending 3 levels of creaking metal staircases, he emerged into a wide, low-ceiling chamber supported by thick concrete pillars, just barely doing their job. Jagged cracks webbed out like lightning bolts from the anchor points, where rusted bolts held the supports in place. The floor above, it seemed, was only staying up through sheer spite alone. As if the environment wasn't precarious enough, the room was blocked off by a series of heavy security gates, each one lacking any sort of electrical interface. No keypads, no scanners, just locked up with old-school padlocks. Fortunately, Gregory had something better than a key. He had a robotic bear, wielding the severed fist of a mechanized gator. Freddy made short work of the chains, snapping them apart with relative ease, allowing them to advance through the barricades, until they reached the final obstacle, the elevator. The obstruction came in the form of a voice-activated security system, but again, thanks to Chica's voice box, Freddy managed to override the command lock and unseal the elevator. Now, the only thing standing between them and the unknown was a tall, rectangular shaft plunging deep into a cavernous void. The only path to get to the elevator was a makeshift bridge of wooden door frames, hammered together haphazardly and nailed directly into the elevator's outer casing. The lift itself looked either ancient or constructed with zero regard for stability. Possibly both. The generator powering the system rested precariously atop a stack of soggy cardboard boxes, while a dangling fuse box leaned over the bridge's edge like it was contemplating the void.
Gregory, be careful. This elevator does not appear to follow any safety protocols. I do not think it can survive more than one trip.
Well, it's not like Fazbear Entertainment ever paid hazard pay. Gregory and Freddy stepped forward, offering a silent prayer to God, fate, or whatever desperate Fazbear engineer welded these panels together, that the cracking bridge would hold on to Freddy's weight. Thankfully, it did. And without another word, they entered the elevator and descended to whatever waited for them below. As I mentioned in the previous episode, what Gregory finds beneath the surface, past the rubble and debris of Freddy's forgotten past, is none other than the Freddy Fazbear's Pizza Place. Yes, that Freddy Fazbear's Pizza Place, the site of Five Nights at Freddy's 6, buried deep underground, either by natural collapse, deliberate corporate cover-up, an expensive one at that, or by some other esoteric and sinister means. Standing sentinel outside the decrepit entrance is a lone staff bot, coated in that ominous black graffiti Gregory had seen before in the underbelly, flanked by several deactivated skeletal endos, naked frames frozen in place and hung up like puppets awaiting new strings. As the duo makes their way inside, they're greeted by a space that, while appearing abandoned from the outside, seems recently disturbed. Modern generators emblazoned with Helpy's ever-grinning face are rigged to power lines and hastily installed lighting fixtures that buzz faintly in the stale air with a light sanguineous taste. Toward the back of the main room, where a wide window opens into an empty, scorched kitchen, a gaping hole pierces the black and white star tile floor. Its jagged edge is surrounded by concrete barricades and hazard tape, as if someone had tried, half-heartedly, to warn intruders off and stay away. Gregory climbed into Freddy's chest cavity, and the animatronic begins his descent within. As they lower themselves into the pit, Freddy speaks, not with his usual mechanical precision or usual optimistic obliviousness, but with rare clarity and human heart. He tells Gregory how Vanessa used him to dig this tunnel, how he first discovered this place, how his friends are trapped below, confused and corrupted. But for the first time, he feels something close to purpose and composure. For the first time, he's certain he can protect Gregory.
I am not me.
The deeper they descend, the more distorted the air becomes around them, thick with dust and the low, guttural resonance of something massive breathing in the dark below. Freddy slows his gait, disturbed by the inhuman growls echoing from the depths. When they finally reach a ledge, a narrow platform suspended near the bottom, Freddy looked down and sees it. A grotesque, towering mass of cables, twisted steel, and half-shredded animatronic limbs and decrepit torsos. An abomination of both past and present, an amalgamation of everything Fazbear Entertainment tried to bury, now bound together into one impossible entity. Larger even than DJ Music Man, the creature's body arced upward like a hill of corpses, and atop its crest, anchored like a crown of rusted gilt, was its head. Its face was a primary mask resembling Freddy Fazbear, but not the glam rock variation, not even the original. This one was fiendish, almost jester-like. Its surface was ghostly white, streaked with grime and ash, with faded purple highlights etched around its eyes, muzzles, and cheeks. Divots break apart the faceplates in places where it appears almost hinged, capable of opening wide like an insect mandible. The creature's thick, snaking neck pulses with every sonorous breath. It was asleep, but it wasn't simply dormant. It was hibernating, but not like a machine resting in standby like DJ Music Man had been. This was different. This is a predator, sleeping, yes, but conserving its strength, waiting for its time to strike. Freddy kept moving forward, cautiously stepping around the tangled mass of machinery. But before they could locate a path beyond the beast, the ground itself made the decision for them. With a heavy step, Freddy shifted his weight, and the floor beneath him gave way. The two plummeted into a hidden room below the creature. A small security chamber, dimly lit and coated in dust. The air smelled of rust and ash. On the far wall, graffiti of a cartoonish purple rabbit loomed above a worn mattress. This must have been another one of Vanessa's hidden corners. At the back of the room stood a bank of monitors, each one hooked to a labeled console. One word stamped above the single button terminal stood out in bold, red text. Incendiary. Gregory approached as a sudden flash of violet light danced across one of the television screens. He leaned in alongside Freddy to get a better view. The image displayed what appeared to be another section of the complex, far deeper within the subterranean maze. There, a heavily modified Pizzaplex charging station hissed open. Lavender fog rolled out like a mist from a crypt. And inside, something stirred. An animatronic figure slowly unfurled from within. Its silhouette was thin, humanoid, and corrupted. A mechanical claw clutched the doorframe as the figure emerged, and its eyes opened, pinprick irises glowing like twin amethysts burning in the dark. It shambled forward. When it stepped into view was a grotesque parody of Bonnie. Torn and discolored brown and yellow plating barely clung to its frame. The degradation was severe, metal warped with age, leaking fluids, and inside the shell, Gregory saw a corpse. The creature lumbered toward a boxy CRT monitor, nearly identical to the one inside the room Gregory was in, and it slammed its mechanical paw down on the glass. At the same moment, Freddy convulsed violently, twitching uncontrollably. His optics flashed and glitched, Roxy's once yellow eyes now slowly bleeding purple.
What was that? Are you okay?
He is trying to take control of me. I do not think I can fight it for long.
What is that thing?
Stop him.
Freddy threw his head back in pain. Gregory stopped questioning and put himself into action. He sprang, slamming his palm onto the incendiary button beneath the appropriate monitor. The screen burst into a white flash, followed by a torrent of flame, engulfing the room where the rabbit creature stood. The fire surged up through floor vents and ignited the walls, forcing the entity to retreat, its silhouette consumed in the blaze. Freddy fell still again, limp, but no longer in pain. What followed was a desperate and harrowing dance. The rabbit thing would return, targeting different terminals in an event to seize Freddy's body. Gregory, in turn, would activate the incendiary defenses again and again, holding the creature at bay. Meanwhile, he was forced to seal entry points, vents, doors, weak spots in the office, as Chica, Monty, and Roxy attempted to break into the room. Not themselves anymore, just mindless instruments of this entity's greater will. As the battle dragged on, the situation grew even more dire. The fires, once controlled, began to spread beyond their containment, climbing walls, igniting exposed cables, leaking through the hidden passages to his office. The underground facility became a furnace. At the same time, holes in the ceiling peeled open, and concrete-concealed panels retracted, revealing sinuous black tendrils descending from above. The tangled blob above had stirred. The tendrils, sleek and searching, swept through the room like baited worms through water, circular and rhythmic in their alluring, probing motion. Gregory ducked and weaved between them, eventually managing to overload the last terminal. The control center on the other side went dark, bursting into flame. The structure in and of itself began to collapse, the fire consuming everything. The rabbit thing knew it too. It turned to flee, but it didn't get far. From behind, thick black tendrils lashed forward,
wrapping around its torso like iron chains. The creature barely registered it, as the entity that was about to capture it lurched down so it could get a better look at its prey. Its faceplate, a white, grinning Freddy mask, cracked and stained, opened, revealing the mechanical endoskeleton beneath. Its eyes burning hot pink, it unleashed a guttural, inhuman scream, then dragged the rabbit thing upward and backward into the inferno. Where it took it exactly, Gregory would never know, and at the moment, he didn't care to find out. He and Freddy were already running through collapsing tunnels, crumbling passageways, and searing heat. Until at last, they emerged. Gregory and Freddy managed to escape. The mission, the nightmares, it was all over. Before returning to what would have to constitute as the new normal, Gregory and Freddy rested themselves atop a hill, relaxing as the shade of the tree behind them, perfect cover to the new morning sun, rising to mark a new day. So, I imagine many of you have questions after that ending. And frankly, so did the entire Five Nights at Freddy's community. Upon release, this ending became infamous. At the time, it was widely regarded as the canon ending to the game. It contained the most narrative content and required the most effort to unlock. And yet, it left us with a cascade of bizarre revelations, presented with little to no setup before abruptly cutting to black. To say people were confused, no, flabbergasted, would be putting it mildly. I dare say some of us were downright bamboozled. Fortunately, with the benefit of hindsight, I think I can offer some clarity on what's going on here. Let's start with the reveal of the Pizzaplex being built over the ruins of the Freddy Fazbear Pizza Place. On its own, that's a genuinely solid twist. However, the game's execution left much to be desired. As highlighted in this audiobook, the idea of a sinkhole isn't introduced until the third act, and even then, it's delivered via text from a collectible message, with no real dramatic weight or buildup to it. It blended in way too easily of that noise of red herrings and flavor text that clutter that game's sloppy lore delivery system. That said, seeing Pizza Place return? That was still cool. It's a bold move, especially if you're familiar with the extended lore in the Tales from the Pizzaplex series. Those stories help fill in the gaps and provide context for what we're seeing here. According to those books, the Pizza Place was originally intended to be part of the Pizzaplex, a retro-themed area showcasing relics from Fazbear Entertainment's past. However, during construction, a certain delivery was made. The Mimic. Once activated, it led to what I refer to as the Second Mimic Massacre. The area was quickly sealed off with cement, its existence and the deaths quietly buried. Eventually, the ground above shifted or gave way, and the location sank further into the depths, either due to structural failure, natural erosion, or deliberate sabotage. Fazbear Entertainment then simply built on top of it, bearing the evidence beneath glitzy rides and neon lights. Now, this is where things get interesting. Vanessa, as we know it, is an unwilling follower, an acolyte of Glitchtrap, itself a digital entity of the Mimic. Once she was in position of power within the Pizzaplex, it was only a matter of time before she began digging down there. Following this, it becomes fairly evident why this ending, despite appearing to be Steeple's original plan for the canon conclusion, was ultimately scrapped. It simply doesn't align with either Scott's overarching narrative intentions or any coherent internal logic in terms of worldbuilding. I mean, let's start with the obvious. Why is there an elevator leading directly to the Pizza Place?
If the location is that deep underground, comparable to the depths explored in Sister location, there is simply no plausible way an active company like Fazbear Entertainment could cover that up from their own engineers. You're telling me the staff maintaining Roxy Raceway, a high traffic attraction, had no idea there was a sealed industrial lift beneath the bleachers? Also, who built that? And why, if they were covering that place up in the first place? Then there's the furnace room. Presumably, the reason the lower levels are perpetually on fire is that they're somehow linked to the incinerator system from FNAF 6. That theory might have held water if the pizza place weren't several stories below ground. So what exactly is fueling this endless blaze? Why is it still burning? Was it awesome? Yes, absolutely. But that's not the point. And like, don't get me started on Burn Trap. Scott Cawthon has since stated outright that Burn Trap was originally conceived as nothing more than a small Easter egg, something tucked away for lore-hungry players to discover.
And I had a specific story for this in mind, okay, for Security Breach. I really did. I had a very specific story in mind, and it is very different than the one that got in the game. And I think a part of that is the way that I conveyed that to Steel Wool. Because what I was trying to do was I was trying to tell Steel Wool to do specific things throughout the game, put specific items in specific places, have specific characters do certain things, meanwhile not telling them what the story plot was. Because I, in my head, I was thinking, okay, when people find this, they will connect this to this to this, and it will all be revealed. And I thought I could do that without telling Steel Wool the story plot. That didn't work out very well because they got all of these pieces and they thought it was their job to connect them in a way that made sense. And so really what you ended up having were the same pieces but telling completely different stories. And since I was trying to kind of tell a specific story with mine that went a certain direction, they were taking pieces I didn't fully understand and trying to craft a story out of them. When it comes to Burn Trap, originally, Burn Trap was never supposed to move. He was supposed to just be something you saw in the corners, or like if you were walking past machinery, you might be able to peek in between two things and see him. And he had a very specific purpose. And I'm not going to say what that purpose was, but realistically, he never moved. Well, obviously, that's not what we got in Security Breach. In Security Breach, we got a capsule opening and purple smoke flowing out and him climbing out and coming to get you. And so it's just not quite the same things.
Well, a rudderless ship sails a rudderless course. Is it any wonder that so many people walked away from that ending with more questions than answers? It felt less like a climactic payoff and more like a jumble of lore spaghetti tossed at the wall to see what might stick. The only two things that you should probably take away from this ending is that the pizza place is below the pizzaplex, and that tangled blob of animatronics resting inside of it. This tangled monstrosity remains an enigma to this day, but its dominant face, that twisted, stained visage of Funtime Freddy, implies something sinister. It's not much of a leap to assume that some remnant of the Sister Location clown bear has survived, clinging to existence in this new grotesque form. Whatever sanity it once had, however, appears to be long gone, replaced with feral instinct and beast-like behavior. Where it goes from here, though? Well, that's up for the future to decide. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Ending 6, Princess Quest. Requirements: Gregory must have completed the Princess Quest arcade cabinets in Chica's Bakery, the Fazcade Backrooms, as well as discovered Vanny's hideout in Fazerblast, where the final arcade cabinet resides, and play the Vanny ending there. Okay, so I'm not even going to try and set things up in an immersive experience because, frankly, there's no way to explain what's happening here. And no, I'm not exaggerating. There is nothing within the game's narrative or canon that offers any coherent explanation for what is going on beyond, this is a video game, just roll with it. So, here's what's happening. This ending can only be achieved by finding and playing through a series of arcade cabinets collectively known as Princess Quest. This minigame actually made its first appearance in the mobile release of Help Wanted, where it could randomly appear on the main menu. The game featured a small yellow sprite, the eponymous princess, traversing a castle and dispelling shadowy rabbit-like creatures before eventually confronting a towering, abyssal bunny entity that ominously declares, "I always come back, let me out," in a coded language. So the parallel there is clear. The princess is meant to represent Vanessa. The game's only concrete purpose at the time was to confirm that William Afton and Glitchtrap are one and the same, and the audience shouldn't interpret it as anything else. This is your friendly reminder that Scott once again confirmed he didn't tell Steeple the plot of Security Breach at any point during its development. Princess Quest would return in Security Breach, with the minigame for Help Wanted returning as Princess Quest 1, which can be found in Chica's Bakery, an utterly pointless location, but we'll eventually get to see more of it in Ruin. Upon completing it, players can track down Princess Quest 2, which is located in the hallway of the Fazcade, the same one where DJ Music Man chases Gregory. Finally, if the player chooses to confront Vanny during the 6 a.m. narrative crossroads, Princess Quest 3 becomes available inside her hidden room in Phazerblast. The sequels serve primarily to confirm that this trilogy of games is a metaphor for Vanessa's internal struggle, her battle to purge the Glitchtrap virus corrupting her mind and regain her independence. In these later entries, she even receives help from a familiar face, a mysterious figure in red robes with a beard and a cane, who introduces himself as Old Man Consequences. Which, by the way, is incredibly cool. I love that he's still around, lurking in the margins of FNAF's lore, doing his cryptic nonsense. I think that's cool. Upon completing Princess Quest 3 and freeing Vanessa from Glitchtrap's control, we're treated to a cutscene. The staff bots across the Pizzaplex shut down, Gregory returns to a heavily damaged Glamrock Freddy, his body disemboweled but his head still functional somehow, and carries him out of the building. Outside, waiting for him, is Vanessa. The game concludes with the trio, Gregory, Vanessa, and Freddy, sitting atop a peaceful hill, the same one from the Burn Trap ending, eating ice cream together as the morning sun rises on a new day. Okay. Instead of outright stating my issues with this ending, allow me to present a challenge. To anyone listening, I invite you to explain clearly and coherently what is happening in this ending, and how any of it makes logical sense within the world of Five Nights at Freddy's. Exactly. Without the meta context of this is just a video game, this entire sequence collapses under even the slightest scrutiny. Nothing about it follows any consistent internal logic or narrative rationale. Why would Gregory, a terrified child on the run, choose to play three retro arcade cabinets scattered throughout the Pizzaplex? How would he possibly know that beating them would somehow liberate Vanessa from Glitchtrap's control? That hidden message he can find from that devil bag? Why did that person know that information? And more importantly, why does that actually work? Gregory, you'll recall, seemed to break free from Glitchtrap's influence without the help of some conveniently placed pixel art dungeon crawler. So why does Vanessa require this convoluted trilogy of trials to purge the virus from her mind? Why would Glitchtrap, or the Mimic, or whoever the fuck is behind the Vanny persona, even design the infection mechanism with a series of arcade-based vulnerabilities in the first place? isn't Glitch Trap supposed to be embedded in Vanessa's psyche? Her actual physical brain? So why would a set of external machines have any bearing on her internal consciousness? Who created the Princess Quest arcade cabinets? They clearly exist in the physical world, so who designed them? Who programmed them? Who had access to that kind of technology and knowledge of Vanessa's mental state? If the answer is the mimic or the storyteller, then I have to ask why? Why would an intelligent predator design an interactive roadmap for its own destruction? Why give your prey the exact steps to defeat you? What kind of villain logic is that? And yes, I know there's some stuff in Ruin and Secret of the Mimic coming up, but if you try and answer with MXES/Georgina, why again? Why? And fine, let's entertain the idea that Gregory somehow gets into Vanessa's secret hideout. Are we supposed to believe that this same murderous woman who has been relentlessly pursuing him for over 6 hours is suddenly just willing to let him stand still and play a full-length arcade minigame unarmed with his back to the door? Really? Thankfully, this ending is also probably not canon. Yes, despite the fact that Princess Quest has arguably the most support for being the definitive conclusion, astonishingly so, as a matter of fact, it becomes increasingly clear upon reflection that it doesn't hold up as canon either. Later developments in the franchise show that Vanessa is still under Glitchtrap's influence, which directly contradicts the implication that she was free through this ending. And once again, it leaves us with a distinct impression that this might have been a case of two creative forces pulling in different directions. Princess Quest possibly being the ending Scott originally envisioned, and the Burn Trap finale being the one Steele assumed was the canon route. Unfortunately, both failed to carve out a narratively compelling or sustainable path forward when they tried to move the plot onward after Security Breach. So what was the solution? Take the pieces that resonated with fans, bits of lore, characters, design, and forge a new direction entirely, one that embraces the Mimic retcon and chooses to rewind the clock a bit, shifting focus toward exploring the deeper origins of this new entity. But of course, that's a story for another time. These endings, they're all just what-if scenarios for now. And if you're curious to discover what really happened to Gregory, Freddy, and Vanessa, and even Roxy, then I invite you to join us for Security Breach Ruin. And with all that said, that closes the book on Security Breach and this episode of Into the Night. It's truly a joy to finally write the last page of this story and share it with all of you. This has been an over 2-year journey, filled with highs and lows, unexpected delays, rewrites, and narratives that span both games and novels. But it has been a journey worth taking, and I am deeply grateful to have walked it alongside you, my friends. I hope you've enjoyed this interpretation of Security Breach, a game which, as many of you know, I am not especially fond of. Oh, wow, I know, shocker. Still, though, this retelling, I feel like I've done my best to present a version of events that feel more aligned with the expectations of the FNAF community, or at the very least, a version that offers a greater clarity and cohesion than what was originally delivered in the game itself. Thank you so much for listening to the Security Breach audiobook series. If you wish to learn more about our upcoming projects, be sure to follow us on X, join our Discord, and subscribe and follow the podcast for instant notifications when a new episode drops. None of this would be possible without all of you. Your viewership means the world to all of us here working on this project. If you'd like to support our future endeavors, be sure to check out our merch store, share the podcast with your friends, or join our Patreon using the link in the description below. As always, I've been your host, Nick Black, and I would like to thank you all once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.